His career spanned more than 70 years, and Ray Bradbury inspired generations of readers to dream, think, and create. Ray Bradbury died on June 5, just this week, at the age of 91. This hour, his absolutely extraordinary life.
I want to identify myself. I'm Ray Bradbury. But you're very curious, aren't you, to find out how I fell in love with books. I learned to read when I was 3 years old. I loved comic strips. I loved the cartoons on Sunday. And I got a book of fairy tales when I was 5 years old, and I fell in love with reading. And when I was six, I saw a film on dinosaurs, and dinosaurs filled my life. A thing that begins when you're 3 and 6 and 10 and 12 wind up in your fictions when you're in your 30s. The things that you do should be things that you love, and things that you love should be things that you do.
And that's the best of advice. This hour, our guest is Professor Jonathan Eller. He's a professor of English and director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University, general editor of Collected Stories of Ray Bradbury, author of Becoming Ray Bradbury. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. I know that many of you are Ray Bradbury fans. The book that was the Waukesha, everybody should read this book, was recently, I think just a couple of years ago, it was the book. And we talked with librarians from Waukesha about how the community was responding to that, Fahrenheit 451. And we're going to look at all that happened in his life, and particularly his young life, that influenced his writing and made him the enthusiastic, optimistic person he was, with our guest this hour. And here's our number to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Professor Eller, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm so glad to join you today.
It was wonderful to hear him, because you get immediately a sense of how engaged this guy was in just about everything. You just want to say, yes, I agree with you. I'll do what I love. Yes.
Well, you know, he sometimes would refer to himself as having a magpie mind, but it really, he's the metaphor man, and I think a better metaphor, another one that he used sometimes, was he's like a pomegranate bursting with seeds. And he would sometimes use that term for other story writers who were good idea people. But I think it really applies to Ray Bradbury. He really was constantly bursting with ideas.
And he just didn't want to let it go. I think he probably didn't want to pass from this earth, did he?
No, I know he didn't. He just enjoyed life so much. He enjoyed telling us about our past, commenting on our present, and looking forward to what the future would bring. And if I can tell you a real quick story about how much he wanted to be here, how much he felt a part of the fabric of this universe, more than once people have asked him at conferences, how are we supposed to remember you, Mr. Bradbury, after you're gone? And he would look at them very seriously and say, well, you don't understand. After I die, you all disappear.
All right. That requires a pause, doesn't it? Tell us the story. He frequently has talked about being 12 years old and having this remarkable experience at a carnival with a man who was quite an interesting guy, who thought that he was the reincarnation of somebody he had been in the war with. But it was this one of these experiences that just changed his life dramatically and got him writing. And it's such a captivating story.
It really is. And, we're talking about a man who is so susceptible to the power of suggestion. And, you know, that's really, he totally embraces that. It's part of his that's the key to his imagination. All his life, he was very susceptible to hypnosis. He would use hypnotic dentist. And because he was a true believer in many ways. And the Mr. Electrico story that you're talking about is probably the keystone example of that. All the carnivals and circuses, you know, it's a big part of the Midwest. Up in Wisconsin, you have, the whole Circus Hall of Fame nexus there. Is it Baraboo?
Right, it's in Baraboo, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, in the 20s and 30s, these circuses and carnivals were still coming through all of the Midwestern states at all times of year, generally between, you know, Memorial Day and Labor Day. But Mr. Electrico was apparently one of the sideshow performers doing the old trick with the static electricity to make it arc and look like you're electrocuting people and making their hair stand up. And when young Ray Bradbury comes that evening to that particular performance, and Mr. Electrico adds the flourish with a little wand that passes the charge so that Ray would exhibit the flying hair, and he says, "Live forever." And that's his, you know, his blessing. And the young boy, as he processes that, he loves literature. He's been living at the library there in Waukegan, Illinois for years already. He wants to be a writer, and now he's focused, and he has a mission. And he's going to be a writer because writers who have the gift, the real special gift of being able to be enduring writers, do live forever.
Mm-hmm. In his childhood, he was very poor. He lost how many of his siblings to the flu?
Well, only two of the four children reached adulthood. The 1918 influenza epidemic took its toll on that family. His mother nearly died of it, and one of the two twin boys she had, Sam, was taken at that time, at the age of, I think, in his second year. Mm. Ray was born just less than 2 years later in 1920, and he and the surviving twin, Skip, who was Leonard Jr., were the two siblings who survived to adulthood. Another daughter was born later in the 1920s, but she died, I believe, of flu or pneumonia or some crib ailment in the late 20s. So, and Ray was old enough to remember that and to see the child and touch the child and realize that the child was gone. So they had that in their family. They were a working class family, a hardworking family, and the Depression had you know, quite an impact on them as well.
So is it really true, or did he make up some of this story, that he met Mr. Electrico and, as the story goes, was so set on fire by him that he went home and started writing? His life was turned around completely, and he never stopped writing.
I think that, again, this is the man so easily susceptible to inspiration. And I think that does focus his life. For a 12-year-old boy to be channeled like that is unusual, but not terribly exceptional, especially if you have a good work ethic and are dedicated to your passions as he was. Yeah, that's a fascinating story. And it's been chronicled fairly well in the biography, The Bradbury Chronicles, by a Chicago journalist, Sam Weller, who really did a lot of research and sleuthing, determining the circus patterns and who Mr. Electrico was. But it's just been so hard to identify this particular sideshow carnival act, but it's definitely a part of Bradbury's life.
Let's talk a little bit more about his reading. He went to libraries. Evidently, he wrote some of his books in a library, but he was a huge fan of libraries and of books and couldn't stand people who burned books or thought certain books should not be in the library. I know librarians love Ray Bradbury and have started All Community Read This Book because of his love for libraries. Let's hear what he says about libraries, and then I'd like for you to talk about his thoughts about libraries.
I was 7 years old when I went to the library for the first time, and I was hoping to find books about The Land of Oz by L. Frank Baum and Tarzan by Edgar Rice Burroughs. That was a great adventure. And I'd open the door of the library, and I'd look in, and all those people were waiting for me in there. You see, libraries is people. People are waiting in there, thousands of people who wrote the books. My greatest influences are John Steinbeck. I read The Grapes of Wrath when I was 19 years old. So you find the author who can lead you through the dark. And Shakespeare started me there. And Hamlet started me there. And Richard III. And Emily Dickinson led the way for me. And Edgar Allan Poe said, "This way, here's the light." That's what a library is. So you go into the library and discover yourself.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? We're on our way. Let's go to the libraries. I have read also in an AP piece about him yesterday that Bradbury was so poor during his early years that he didn't have an office or a telephone, and he wrote Fahrenheit 451 at the UCLA library on typewriters that rented for 10 cents a half hour. He said he carried a sack full of dimes and completed the book in 9 days at the cost of $9.80. Is that true?
Yes, you know, he's the master storyteller, and sometimes, you know, the edges of any writer's reminiscences blur a little bit toward the romantic. But the one thing that I found, especially in writing this book on his early years, was that essentially all of these stories are fundamentally true. What makes the fabric of his life so interesting, this great passion for books, this desire to succeed as a writer combined with great good luck, and also some of the breaks that he made for himself, meeting certain people at certain key points in his life. Fahrenheit is another example of that. Exactly. They had just moved. He and his wife, Maggie, had one daughter, Susan, at the time, was still an infant, had moved up from Venice Beach, where they had lived at 33 Venice Boulevard, a little rented bungalow duplex, had moved up, and with the... you know, his upturned fortunes after the Martian Chronicles and a little money from the family, had bought a house on Clarkson Road near Westwood, which was, you know, the main road north-south up to UCLA. And although he had done some draft work, we know here at the center we have some examples of some draft work. He was already beginning to write a story about the firemen who burned down houses to burn the books, but he did have this beautiful 9-day burst of creativity in the UCLA library when he discovered the typing room there. There were fewer distractions than there were at home, where he was working out in the garage, but there was there were still the domestic distractions, and he just needed a focused burst to bring this longer story out in probably late summer of 1950. He finished it. It was called The Fireman at that time, and published as a novella. And then 2 years later, he returned to the UCLA library, went through the same process when he felt the need to expand it to 50,000 words from the 25,000 word original, and retitled it The Temperature at Which Book Paper Burns, which he found from one of the fire department offices was 451 degrees Fahrenheit.
Interesting. So he had to write a lot of words a day, and he did, as I understand it, have a discipline where he would sometimes wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and go to his study and write, and he would write a certain number of words. He had to keep at it. He was very disciplined at the process, considering how prolific the guy was.
Yes, and he was he did have that passion for it. He had his pattern that he was best with. And during those years, I think in the early 50s, he did do a bit of working at night. He would go out to the garage and work at the Clarkson Roadhouse. Later on, he settled into the more natural routine for him of early morning writing. He would wake up and his mind would play what he would call the theater of the mind, when the good ideas come and begin to mix together. And so, a good 4 hours into the middle of the day was his normal pattern. But yes, he did write at night sometimes as well. You know, his method was different from, say, Hemingway's, but no less of an applied method where Hemingway would be trying to write that truest sentence, the best sentence, always lean, always bare. Mm-hmm. Bradbury would not filter initially. He wanted the ideas to come up, to well up from his muse, unrestricted.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned in that piece that we heard Steinbeck and Shakespeare and others. When you read him, and you've read all of him, do you see a certain literary style that was influenced by either of those people or others?
Probably the greatest thing he did, and what gave the world Ray Bradbury, was his realization in his early 20s that he had to stop imitating writers.
Oh, interesting.
He had, in high school, imitated Poe and Lovecraft, and his first assignment story that he turned in at L.A. High School was, as he would call it, a lift from the story plot of King Kong. He would imitate a wide range. He'd imitate Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. He'd imitate P.G. Wodehouse. And was just always playing and experimenting. But in the early 40s, under the gentle mentorship of other writers who were members of the science fiction, the Los Angeles Science Fiction League chapter there in Los Angeles, he realized he had to find the fundamental wells of creativity within himself. Now, he still had the library passions. He still wanted to be on the shelves someday, you know, between Mr. Baum, Mr. Burroughs, near Miss Dickinson, and not too far down from Mr. Poe or Miss Welty or Mr. Whitman. He always had that desire, but he knew he couldn't imitate. And by the middle of World War II, and he was deferred for eyesight and Red Cross blood drive writing. As alternative service during the war, he wrote constantly on his short fiction, and he learned then to write about the things he knew best, the inner passions, the child within, the things that we are scared of as children, the things that we yearn for as children, and how we deal with the world, negotiate the world. These were the universal things that were Ray Bradbury, and he couldn't be writing detective stories or adventure stories like King Kong or H.P. Lovecraft horror stories. That wasn't Ray Bradbury. And he became a writer who then other writers came to admire. He met John Steinbeck once in 1945, never telling him that he himself was a young writer. But he learned later from Steinbeck's son that the children were read Ray Bradbury stories by their father.
Oh my, what news that must have been for him.
Yeah, it just made him cry.
Oh, I bet it did. Makes us cry. Let's welcome phone calls. We want to delve a little bit more into the book that you probably can't find on library shelves today, and that's Fahrenheit 451. And it has been the book that has been chosen for a lot of the community reads. It was, some have said, Bradbury's only true science fiction work. We'll ask our guest if he would agree with that, and we'll hear what Bradbury has to say about that book. And we'd like to welcome your phone calls as well. I know that many of you are Ray Bradbury fans. Maybe you'll choose a book to read now. I frequently do this when someone passes and they've influenced your life and you want to go back and read them. What book would you choose of all that he wrote or television shows that he did? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I know a lot of teachers teach him in kind of a package with other writers, like George Orwell, 1984, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Those books are tend to be put together in terms of pay attention to a world that you may not want to have happen. All right. So let's pause for a moment and return. We'll hear Bradbury's comments on Fahrenheit 451 and talk more with our guest this hour, who sure is a great guest. Jonathan Eller is a professor of English and director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. Professor Eller is general editor of Collected Stories of Ray Bradbury and author of Becoming Ray Bradbury, among other books that he's written about the author. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ray Bradbury, the focus of our conversation this hour. He died at the age of 91 on Tuesday of this week. Let's explore the book that may be the most famous of all, maybe not, but one that certainly has received a great deal of critical attention and is still read by many students all over this country, Fahrenheit 451.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
Is it true that a long time ago, firemen used to put out fires and not burn books.
Oh, really, your uncle is right. You are light in the head. Put fires out. Who told you that?
Oh, I don't know, someone. But is it true? Did they?
Oh, what a strange idea.
Tell me, that number you all wear, what's it mean?
Oh, Fahrenheit 451.
Why 451 rather than 813 or 129?
Fahrenheit 451 is the temperature at which book paper catches fire and starts to burn.
There's nothing there. The books have nothing to say. All about people that never existed. The people that read them, it makes them unhappy with their own lives, makes them want to live in other ways they can never really be.
From Fahrenheit 451. Ooh, it's just chilling to just hear that portion of that, isn't it?
It really is, and I believe that that's from the François Truffaut 1966 film version, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that was Cyril Cusack there as reprising his role, masterful role as fire chief Beatty, giving the rationale for why people don't need to read anymore. It's just confusing. People don't need to read serious literature because it's confusing. It's not reality. It makes our minds confused and it upsets us. This is the narcotic that they're passing out to the people get them to read just surface advertisements and pleasure magazines.
Bradbury said about this book, it was based on real facts and also on my hatred for people who burn books.
Well, that's definitely the case. He was from a very young age, he had learned about the loss of the great library at Alexandria in a fire, of course, in the early centuries A.D. And we have, a pretty good trail of destruction from that point on, and so many classics were lost and never made it even into the Renaissance, let alone modern times. And that bothered him. And then when he saw that happening in the 20th century, under Stalin, under Hitler, and even during the Cultural Revolution in China, it profoundly affected him, because to burn the book is to burn the author. And if you burn the author, you're burning and destroying our own humanity.
We have many people who are joining us by phone. Cindy in Eau Claire, our first caller. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi.
My last name is Bradbury.
Really?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, you have six generations of Bradbury's out of Waukegan, where Ray's hometown is, so you could be related.
We looked into it, and his grandfather and my great grandfather were either brothers or cousins. I can't quite remember, but we are shirt tail relations of his. And if we're not, I still claim him. I think that I've read almost all of his books, and it's really kind of timely, because about 2 weeks ago I bought about six of his books off of eBay because I didn't have them in my personal library.
Thank you, Cindy, so much for your call. I would imagine in this area we may hear from, because he was born in Waukegan, we may hear from people who are related to him.
Well, that great-grandfather was at one time mayor of Waukegan and ran newspapers in the town. So, down through even Bradbury's generation, the fathers and the uncles and the aunts, Ray's father and mother, they would sometimes go on vacation up to Lake Delavan in Wisconsin, because it wasn't all that far away for them.
Right. Oh. Thanks, Cindy, so much for your call. Jennifer in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Oh, not bad for a Thursday. I just wanted to call to, you keep talking about his, World War II influences, but, the first book, or it's a short story, I guess, that got me interested was There Will Come Soft Rains, which, is really indicative of the Cold War era. So just wanted to bring it up, I guess.
Yeah, that's a that is a fascinating story. It's probably, you know, Bradbury's, one of his gifts is this ability to have focused emotional impact. That's one of the things that makes Fahrenheit important. It's written with vitality, intensity, and emotional impact, even if you find it overly alarmist not strong enough. People do appreciate the emotional impact. And that beautiful story, There Will Come Soft Rains, title based on the Sarah Teasdale poem of that title, the day after a nuclear conflagration, where the house of the future lives on in its electronic ways, where the family and everybody else has been removed by some atomic catastrophe, or this is before the concept of the neutron bomb, but it's reflective of the memories of Hiroshima, because you see on the wall of the house the reflections, the ash burns still of the little boy and girl who had been playing ball, and the ball suspended in the air in the ash embedment into the wall of the house. Very sobering, and yet the house lives on for one more day before a chance fire sets up its own destruction. Ray pulled that about the time that he condensed it for Collier's Magazine, which published a lot of good fiction and a lot of Ray Bradbury fiction around 1950. He pulled it in its original expanded form immediately into the Martian Chronicles, and it becomes the next to last chapter of the Martian Chronicles, showing the fate of Earth. Just before, in the final chapter, he shows some families going out for the hope of the future on a return to Mars.
Hmm. Of all of the writers in this world, why have you chosen Bradbury to spend your life studying?
Well, it's sort of the second half of life for me. I spent the first half of my adult life in the Air Force, and at one time in the late 80s, I was teaching at the Air Force Academy, and we brought Ray Bradbury out, among other science fiction writers, for a conference on science fiction. We had Joe Haldeman and Octavia Butler and David Brin, and Ray Bradbury was the keynote speaker.
Huh.
Simply, I was assigned to him since I was a scholar who specialized in that area. I had read a lot of Ray Bradbury in the early 60s as a child, and it was I had picked up that dreamlike world of Ray Bradbury from such collections as The Illustrated Man and The Golden Apples of the Sun, the two books that came out right after The Martian Chronicles in the early 1950s, and began to work together after that time, occasionally at first, and over the last 15 years, much more often, on various projects, special editions of some of his books and unpublished materials. And then he helped me so much on the writing of Becoming Ray Bradbury and the sequel to it, which I'm nearly through with now. And so I, you know, like every other American of that period, it seems like I had read Ray Bradbury, enjoyed Ray Bradbury, but I never thought I would meet him. But in the 19 years since I've retired from the Air Force and been a professor here at Indiana University in Indianapolis, I have, you might say, been able to devote a large part of my professional life to Ray Bradbury studies.
And tell me about the times that you were with him. Was he as happy, optimistic, well-spoken, makes you want to go out and live your life as he appears to be in those clips we're hearing?
Oh, yes. A great lover of life. A giant of a man in many ways. He just emoted encouragement. He was so encouraging.
Mm.
I remember one time, it must have been around 1998, I was out that fall, and I still sort of had a military frame of mind even in my civilian life, and it was, you know, you have your objectives, you do them that day, and you weigh the day, and I remember saying to him at the end of one day, okay, well, we did a lot of things. I said, this was a good day, and he looked at me and he said, every day's a good day. and that's all he needed to say, you know. And so he could be quietly enthusiastic, but he could be incredibly dynamic as well. He learned in the late 40s, in his late 20s, that to read papers on how to write, to students was deadly. And he threw his notes, he threw his text, his prepared text away, and worked from light notes or sometimes without any notes at all. And he became a remarkable speaker. He has a, had a great voice, a beautiful voice that could move above from its basic baritone register. And he would talk to many school audiences, but it radiated out. By the 60s and 70s, he was talking to industry, he was talking to audiences, he was in high demand. And by the early 1980s, when he finally, at the age of 62, decided that he would give up planes and go ahead and conquer his fear of flying and began to fly around the country and to Europe, then he was a very high demand, high profile public speaker and always a joy to listen to.
That's a wonderful story. Deborah in Madison, hi.
Yeah, I couldn't let the hour go by without reminding people of his, the first thing I ever read of his when I was a child was Dandelion Wine. And I started with the short story and then later the novel when he expanded it. But this wonderful story, it's him, his childhood in, I think he, it was a mythical Greentown,
that's right,
Illinois. But it was, he had a way of capturing the just the wonders of childhood. It reminded me of that. I remember something about the cream sponge pair of Lightfoot sneakers and the
yes, that story about the new set of tennis shoes every summer, the ritual of the new set of tennis shoes, is often reprinted with various titles, and that's one of the real mouthful titles. Of course, everything in Dandelion Wine appears without its titles. They just simply have line breaks or page breaks between each of the interlocking episodes. It takes you from the beginning of summer to the end of the summer in 1928. I'm really glad you brought that book up because I think we do need to get back and talk about a little bit of how that contributes to his career and his lasting power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Deborah, very much for the call. Are there other works that you want to mention that contribute? He was so prolific, it would be hard to go through all that he did, but are there others that are particularly important to his career, to the fact that he received such critical attention?
Well, it's very interesting to track the where his history of popularity runs from about 1950 on. He was already well known in genre circles throughout the 40s for, you know, detective work and weird tales, dark and light fantasy, and science fiction, which he became sort of brought his unique brand blend of science fiction, science fantasy in the late 40s. But from 1950 on, where he's publishing books that have never gone out of print. Generally speaking, The Martian Chronicles was the perennial favorite. And then after 1957, Dandelion Wine became almost as popular as The Martian Chronicles. And for decades, that was the way it was. Because Dandelion Wine, as our last caller really implied, that really captures something very important. This is Bradbury does for the small town of America what John Steinbeck and John Dos Passos did for the big cities. They gave us the big city. Ray Bradbury gave us Greentown, Illinois, and he gave us the small town where two or three generations of a family lived together in the same house, and the younger ones respected their elders, and everybody had a Maxfield Parrish print on the wall, and you could walk down the street and hear somebody's piano playing "Beautiful Ohio." This is that world that he projects into all his books, even into a chapter of The Martian Chronicles. But over time, I would say starting in the 1980s or 1990s, although those remain perennial favorites, Fahrenheit eventually became his most popular, his bigger selling book, because as we moved into the 21st century, it became once again important as a cautionary tale, not just about book burning or censorship, but about the challenges of how do we maintain the importance of literacy and reading in this increasingly visual culture. We have to safeguard, we've got to make sure that the wonders of technology and our real love affair with multimedia entertainments which in many cases rise to great art forms, does not eclipse the importance of literacy and literature in our world. And you know, you don't have to burn the books. You just have to get people to stop reading them, Ray would say.
Right.
And there are many ways to do that. Yeah. And as he showed in Fahrenheit, you can give them the slick magazines, you can give them advertisements, you can give them television shows on all four of your walls with interactive capabilities for the viewer. And so Fahrenheit is important on so many levels that go beyond the polarized McCarthy era when the book was written and the censorship that was going on then. It goes far beyond that because it shows the dilemma and the challenges, I would say, more than a dilemma, and the choices we have to make to maintain the popularity and the importance of reading in this very, very visual world we're in.
Mm, beautifully said. Steve in Madison, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to add my own little footnote to this. I'm 64 years old, and I have been a science fiction fantasy reader basically all my life, and I owe that to Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles. When I was about 12 or 13, I found a beat-up copy in our local library, and I read it, really not knowing what science fiction was, fell in love with it, and have been reading it ever since. And the thing about that copy that I found was a couple of years later, they were having a library sale, and so I bought it for like a quarter. I'm pretty sure it was the first edition, and I certainly wish I had it now.
Well, he had moved to Doubleday for the Martian Chronicles. He had published a book with a very famous Wisconsin publishing house, August Derleth's publishing house, Arkham House. August Derleth was from Sauk City and maintained his headquarters there for many years. He was very well known in Weird Tales and other genre literatures. But Bradbury had moved beyond and sort of brought a lot of the genre literature along with him. Other writers did this too, but Bradbury did it very dramatically. And by 1950, he had his Doubleday contract with a major New York trade house, and Martian Chronicles came out in May 1950, and that first edition would be worth something today, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray would say that at times he's called it his only science fiction book, or sometimes he would refer to Fahrenheit as his science fiction book. He now calls that a sociological novel. What is the Martian Chronicles? It's certainly a novelized story cycle. It's a fable. It's a mythology for the space age. Do we go into space and do the same kind of frontier exploitation and destruction that we've done on parts of our own planet? Or do we learn how to move out toward the stars?
Hmm. And let's talk just a little bit more. When he talked about Fahrenheit 451 being his only true science fiction work, Ray Bradbury saying that all his other works should be classified as fantasy, is there a substantial difference between the two, and does it make a difference for us to differentiate among his works?
Well, those are questions I'd love to hear my colleagues and mainstream writers and editors and critics talk about Bradbury in this context. I'm more of a historian of literature, and that's sort of my track down through my take on Ray's fiction. But I would say that overall, and one of the things that makes him of lasting importance into this next century is that whatever labels we give him, they can't really be genre labels, because he never followed the rules of the genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he
mm-hmm.
didn't plot out detective fiction backwards. He did not have any, you know, he didn't have a ratiocinative bone in his body, as Poe teaches us and other writers in that tradition teach us. You have to know how it ends and work backwards from there. That's simplistic, but that's basically how it works, and he didn't do that. He lets those characters run away. Now, we all know that this is a trick of the mind. He's telling himself his characters are writing his own stories, and on one level he knows that. But still, he works a forward and without any sense of how it's going to end. And in certain genres, that's crazy. It's not how it's done. And so he never really followed genre labels, but was nevertheless successful because he's really a myth maker, and that's what I mean by a real importance for the future. He's a mythos writer. He's a mythopoeic writer, like C.S. Lewis, like J.R.R. Tolkien. But he's writing the myth for the space age. What must we do to survive as a race? You use the rockets not to deliver warheads, but to go to the stars and to gain immortality by going to the stars. And he shows how people will stumble along the way. They'll be terribly lonely in outer space. There may be terrible disasters and terrible crimes in outer space, but eventually we'll get it right. He always felt we would get it right.
Let's welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Jonathan Eller, professor of English, director of the Center for the Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. He's editor of Collected Stories of Ray Bradbury and author of Becoming Ray Bradbury, and is just completing, as he said, another book on Bradbury, which will soon be released. Another of the movies, we played a clip from Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes. We will hear a portion of that and talk about that as we return, and we also will hear Ray Bradbury talking about his life and his writing as we wrap up our hour. And we'll take your phone calls. We have a lot to do. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is from the film Something Wicked This Way Comes.
I know who you are. You are the autumn people. Where do you come from? The dust. Where do you go to? The grave.
Yes. We are the hungry ones. Your torments call us like dogs in the night. And we do feed. And feed well.
To stuff yourselves on other people's nightmares.
And butter our plain bread with delicious pain. So, you do understand a little.
You are known in this town. My father knew you.
Your father? The preacher? That half man?
You'd have done goodness.
Tasteless fare. Funerals. Bad marriages. Lost loves. Lonely beds. That is our diet. We suck that misery and find it sweet. We search for more, always. We can smell young boys ulcerating to be men 1,000 miles off. And hear a middle-aged fool like you groaning with midnight despairs from halfway around the world. Your books cannot hurt me, old man. Yes, old. Because your heart is old. Listen to it.
From Something Wicked This Way Comes, Ray Bradbury, this the film. We haven't really talked about how many films and his whole television series as well. He had a huge career in these areas as well. Were the films well done? Was he happy with what was on screen that came from his books?
You know, he had always wanted to write for the cinema. He had wanted to be an actor as a child. He realized he couldn't remember lines, and he got out of even amateur theater by the age of 20. But he knew he had jumped the walls at Paramount and MGM and the other studios of the late 30s. After arriving there in 1934 at the age of 14 with his family, where his father was looking for work, he had come. Waited at the gates of all the studios, had gotten thousands of autographs, and now he was finally able to come in the front gates of the studios and began to write for film in 1952. And he was intriguing and attractive for Hollywood producers. Didn't always get along with the executives, but producers and directors and a lot of actors always wanted to work with him. The films have, mixed level of success. Some of the concepts he came up with, it came from outer space in 1953 release. It was, the first, one of the first science fiction movies where the thinking scientist analytically saw solves the problem in the film. It's not a bad film at all. But a lot of times his films from his scripts didn't come to fruition. The Martian Chronicles is an example of that. Fahrenheit is an example of that, although he was very happy with the way that François Truffaut and cinematographer Nicholas Roeg worked with Fahrenheit. The Illustrated Man was not from a Ray Bradbury script in 1969, but in 1983, Disney and Brenna Productions did release Something Wicked This Way Comes, based on a Ray Bradbury script, with a number of revisions to it. Parts of that film he finds incredibly riveting. I think we all do. The scene you just played in the library, where Jason Robards is the father of one of the two child protagonists, and Jonathan Pryce, Mr. Dark, of Kujer and Dark's traveling carnival, confront each other in the library. And that's a terrifying scene. It's one of the great scenes of dark fantasy, I think, ever filmed. Just a phenomenal phenomenal scene.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to as many phone calls. We have tons of calls, which is wonderful. Chris in Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm glad that you're giving some recognition to his horror stories, because I think The October Country is probably the single best one-author collection of horror stories I've ever encountered, or what I now call dark fantasy. I called, however, because the I vaguely remember that he'd written one script for Twilight Zone and no more, because he did not get along with Rod Serling. And since they seem, I wonder if that's the case, and since they seem so much alike, why didn't they get along?
Well, Serling and Bradbury both came to doing things like The Twilight Zone, and eventually a quarter of a century later, Ray Bradbury Theater, because you could say things in science fiction and fantasy horror teleplays that you couldn't say in realistic teleplays. Serling had been so award-winningly popular in the mid-50s with his teleplays in really the golden age of dramatic TV, but yet he turned to The Twilight Zone because then he could you know, he could push the envelope a little further. Mm. And this is something they very much had in common. And yes, Ray did, they did use a Ray Bradbury script for the Electric Grandmother episode, known, it's actually I Sing the Body Electric, that line from Walt Whitman that Ray writes about the Electric Grandmother and how it revives a familyhood that has lost its mother. And there were other scripts. I think Ray was disappointed at that particular production, and there were other scripts that had been bought for The Twilight Zone that were then, I think, returned to Bradbury. So, you know, in the long run, he had a good beginning relationship with Rod Serling, and they both had a vision for the same kind of thing. But in the long run, Ray Bradbury knew he had to go out and do it on his own, and he eventually did.
Thank you, Chris. Steve in Madison, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to share my... Can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to share my my little story about Ray Bradbury. I fell in love with his books when I was in high school, and when I went off to college, I was kind of struggling emotionally my freshman year and feeling lonely, and I just... I think I wrote him a letter. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I kind of wrote him a letter. And, you know, not really expecting to ever hear back, but he wrote back. Actually, he typed back on his typewriter and then hand-corrected all his spelling mistakes and typos. And I've kept the letter to this day. And, you know, he said, "Dear Stephen, you said in your letter you didn't know exactly why you were writing to me, but I know you were writing me a love letter. And I was deeply moved, pleased, touched by your kind words about my books and stories. I wish you well in the years." I won't read you the rest of it. But anyway, and then he autographed it. And then there was a little P.S. "Halloween, by God, 1981. And he drew a pumpkin right underneath that statement.
That's beautiful. That's quite a treasure. Ray celebrates the love between author and subject, and he celebrates the love between reader and author. He is such a loyal writer. He was such a loyal writer to his fans. He autographed like a champ. He autographed probably as much as any writer in contemporary times. I was very grateful to his fans, and he tried, always tried, even without a large infrastructure around him, he would always try to answer the mail, and in often very poetic and beautiful and encouraging ways.
What a beautiful letter. What a beautiful letter. Indeed, perhaps he did have total recall of what it was like to be every age that he was, as some have said. Thank you so much, Professor Eller. We're going to start, we're going to end the show with Bradbury on his life and his writing. You've been a wonderful guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing such terrific work on this tribute to Ray Bradbury, who passed from this earth on Tuesday.
In the instant of getting an idea, I go act it out on paper. I don't put it away. I don't delay. I don't put off to tomorrow doing what I must do right now to find out what my secret self needs, wants, desires with all its heart. And then it speaks, and I have enough brains to get out of the way and listen. And 2 hours later, sitting at the typewriter, you look at the paper and you say, ah, so that's what I think about the death of Hemingway. Is that how much I was hurt? So that we act out these tensions continually. We keep cleansing the stream, just as any impurity running downhill in a river, by the time it travels 9 miles, is purified. So the life of a man traveling to the sea, which is our inevitable death someday, purifies itself. It must. Because if you do not purify, these tensions remain in and turn in on yourself and destroy you.